radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. As fall begins to approach us here, at this point we're taping this, Brother Wilbur is on his way back from being a brave firefighter in the Bronx, and Brother Shand is out starting to feel the cold chill of some weather up in Wisconsin here. So we're doing this at different points today, and here's some of the things that we're going to talk about. Some recent incidents or accidents of certainly of note. One of the ones that's been sent around on YouTube probably more times than Brother Mike and I can count. We'll talk about some of the recent accident of two apparatus hitting one another at an intersection in St. Louis and several others. And then we're going to go into some discussions of equipment mounting and things that we as emergency service personnel feel compelled that we want to bring inside the cab with us and carry. That's gotten a lot of notoriety as of late, and amplified by some of the accidents that just occurred. I think it bears some discussion. There's been a couple of discussion threads up on the web on firehouse.com about the people who bring things into the cab, and they've ranged from a guy who claimed that he has a pair of irons lying on the floor and he's proud of it, and a couple of other people that think that maybe we should be a little bit more wiser. So we'll push those things back and forth a little bit. And then we'll follow up that discussion coming back from the break about, from a realistic perspective, what can we do to make us respond safer? Safety's been a big thing, obviously, in a lot of our discussions, and with emphasis put out by not only the NFPA but the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. And it's nice to maybe talk the talk, but what are we going to do actually to put this in practice to make sure that we do operate in a safe and, in my perspective, a sane manner at all times? We've received a couple of questions from our listeners, and we'll hit those. And then we'll end up today's podcast and discussion about anything that we've seen lately, whether it was a piece of equipment or a operations that's really impressed us. As the travel season tends to wind down here as we get into the fourth quarter, thought it might be appropriate to kind of reflect back on some of the neat places that Michael and I have visited separately, as well as team teaching together in some places, and things that might be worthwhile for our listeners to go check out. So having said that, Brother Mike, responding back carefully, I take it, from the Bronx, take us through some of the wires and, on your laptop, and what's got you in a mood to chat about.
Thanks, Brother Tom. We've had another high activity month, unfortunately, as it relates to accidents and incidents and line of duty and non-line of duty firefighter deaths. One of the things that we highlight, and it's not line of duty but rather off-duty firefighter motorcycle deaths, there have been several in recent weeks. I think the good Lord, Tom, only allows you to have one bad motorcycle wreck, and it's generally not survivable. Many times, you know, I talk to people, and they say, well, I'm a good rider. Well, it doesn't matter if you're a good motorcycle rider. If somebody else isn't paying attention out there, you have very little to protect you, and our condolences to those that have passed away on motorcycles. An Illinois firefighter was killed earlier this month in a rollover, and ironically enough, it was just during a training exercise. Unfortunately, a Blue Mound volunteer firefighter was driving a tanker truck. He was 24 years old. It happened on a Monday night about 8:30. County coroner said that the cause of death was due to a pre-existing condition. However, it was not elaborated as to what that was. The department was conducting a training exercise when the tanker loaded with water just overturned. That firefighter was airlifted and died. And what's interesting is that there was another firefighter on board that vehicle that survived, and along with the pre-existing medical condition, you have to wonder if perhaps seatbelts may have played a role in that as well. Just conjecture, but one would have to look there for sure. Another place that we have not done well of late are POVs. We have one firefighter dead and three or four more injured this month in personally operated vehicle wrecks. It's always a challenge to get from home to the fire station as a volunteer or a call firefighter or a career firefighter that's been called back to duty. And those challenges still exist. I guess the watchword here is that you're not good to anybody if you don't get there. And so you really have to slow down and take your time and watch out for the other drivers that, for the most part, necessarily aren't watching out for you, which was in the case of our next wreck in Gary, Indiana, where a civilian ran a red light right in front of a Gary, Indiana ladder truck, and they got the car right in the civilian driver's door, and the civilian was killed. And unfortunately, that crew has to live with that for the rest of their lives, even though it was not their fault. You know, they were going to a run. They had the lights activated, the siren activated. They had the green light. And they were doing everything, by all accounts, right. And still, it just turned out all wrong. And there just seems to be more and more inattentive driving. As I drove up from the Bronx this morning to do the show, Tom, it was just, I saw somebody reading a newspaper that was stuck in traffic, and people just doing all kinds of crazy things behind the wheel other than paying attention to the task at hand. And of course, those are the folks that we have to take emergency vehicles and drive around. And then finally, to wrap up here, what's probably going to go down, certainly this year, is maybe one of the most famous wrecks of all. It's all over YouTube, is where two St. Louis City Quints hit each other at an intersection, evidently going to the same box, but yet they were crossing the intersection at the same time and then going in different directions. Whatever else has occurred during that run, for sure on the videotape, it's unmistaken that one of the Quints ran the red light and was struck in the back compartment by the other Quint. It spun it around and flipped over. On the upside, everyone was seated and belted on board the apparatus, and they basically unbelted and walked away with only minor injuries. Again, much can be contributed to the construction of the custom cabs and the fact that everybody was seated and belted in. One would have to think, just looking at the video, that the injuries would have been far worse had not everybody been belted in, particularly the officer in the rig that had the green light, who took the bulk of it on the right front bumper of that apparatus. Had he not been belted in, probably would have been ejected and landed somewhere on Mars. And interesting to note that St. Louis, I just got an email, St. Louis was the home of the On the Quiet policy, so obviously they were going to something pretty serious, and somebody failed to stop at the light. If the light is red, you have to stop. You have to stop, or more and more of this is just going to continue to occur. What else do you have for us today, Tom?
Well, you know, Mike, before we launch into the equipment discussion, I just want to comment on two things that you mentioned. One was with respect to inattentive drivers or drivers that are distracted for whatever reason. And for most of our listeners know from across the country, there are some states, Michael and I both reside at opposite ends of the great empire state of New York, and they do have a hands-free law with respect to cell phone use, which means you're not supposed to be on a cell phone and holding it up to your ear. You need to have some type of hands-free device or earpiece. And any time that I'm driving around my local community, particularly if I'm out with my wife and we're cruising around to go out to grab a bite to eat or something, and you start paying attention as a civilian now, and particularly when you come up to a stoplight and can observe, you know, not only the people in your lane, but maybe on either side of you or people that are stopped on the opposite lanes, and you start looking around. In our great state, where they do have a law on the books, and my brother just got nabbed for talking on a cell phone by a state trooper, and the fee for that little ticket was $180. You start looking at people that are on the cell phones, and it's just like, well, the law's there, but it doesn't really exist because they're not worried about anybody enforcing it. Well, they're clearly distracted because they're thinking about something else. Conversely, and out on a business trip several days ago, Mike, I pull up to a stoplight, and there's a guy that's in the lane, in the passing lane opposite me, and he cruises in to go into the turn lane to make a left, and he's got a book unfolded on his steering wheel, and he apparently was driving down the road while he was enriching himself by reading some novel. Now, I think we as emergency responders, when we are driving the apparatus, where we in the past maybe have assumed that we are going to get the right of way, that people are going to recognize us because we're big, we're bold, we weigh 40,000 pounds plus, whatever color of the rainbow your apparatus might be, and we've got audible devices and every warning light known to man activated. If the people are on the cell phone or engaged in reading a book or doing whatever, Mike mentioned in a previous time you saw, you know, a woman breastfeeding or putting on her makeup, we need to reverse by 180 degrees our assumption, Mike, to think that the people are going to recognize us and assume that they're not. And don't take anything for granted. The more you drive around and forget about even going into people that, you know, have their iPods going and the stereo and everything else, the people are not really thinking about yielding the right of way to anybody. If you happen to be in an intersection sometime, watch what happens the next time an ambulance tries to cut through an intersection and how many people want to go play footsie with the ambulance. Just because we're bigger doesn't grant us any ability to assume that they're going to grant us or give us the right of way. And as was evidenced once again in the tragic accident with St. Louis, when you come up to a signal-controlled or a sign-controlled intersection and that red light or that stop sign is not, as Gordon Routley said one time when we were out traveling, it's just merely a suggestion that you might want to tap the brakes. It absolutely means you need to come to a stop. It was only, I think, by the grace of God, Mike, that the brothers were seated and belted on the St. Louis units. If you look at some of the after film footage on that or some of the still photography and look at the physical damage to both of those pieces of apparatus, one was a spare, looked like it was a Pierce Telescope. It was the spare engine was the one that got hit at the right rear, and the other one was a Spartan chassis 75-foot Quint. Both of those units sustained heavy damage at the points of impact, and particularly when you look at that Spartan and look at how that cab held up, but yet it appeared to look like the windshield glass blew out. If those members had not been belted in, as Mike said, they would have been launched. Which brings us into our healthy discussion of equipment mounting. Imagine for a moment that you are riding in that canopy cab Pierce Telescope that got hit broadside. In this case, it happened to be hit by another fire truck, but it could have gotten hit by somebody, you know, blowing a light or whatever. And you now find yourself, instead of riding in the normal position, you are now 90 degrees to the ground, and anything that was around you, surrounding you, starting with your, if you even had a cup holder there and you had your little 7-Eleven big gold cup there loaded up with ice and water, or anything that is not permanently mounted that can sustain an impact, that's going someplace where you don't expect it to go and very likely can be headed to you. So, Mike, I have to put you on the spot here, but if you jump up in the front seat of Ladder 27, just give our listeners a little description of from left to right, from the driver's side of the cab around like 180 degrees in front of you and out to the window on the other side. What is normally sitting in the front seat of your rear mount ladder as you go down the road, either on AFID or going out on building inspections, you're going out on a run? What is sitting in the front seat of your rig?
Well, unfortunately, Tom, generally the chauffeur has put in four or five fusee flares under his seat so that when he gets out in an MVA, he has some kind of protection on the roadside, which, of course, is certainly no excuse to have that equipment not secured someplace. I believe there's a Sawzall there that is secure by his seat. We go around onto the front windshield, and there's a map book, and then there's a couple of I can't even remember what they are. Slim Jims, that's it. A couple of Slim Jims on the windshield. We go around in between the chauffeur and my position. There's a thermal imaging camera that is actually lashed into the rig. There's a flashlight in a charger that is not, that if we tipped over, the flashlight would become a projectile. There's an officer's tool that's mounted in between the door and the well for the footstep. And that pretty much does it. We're not 100%, but we have a lot of stuff that's fastened down in the confines of the front seat. And then obviously the officer's SCBA is in the seat as well.
Well, I think your situation, Mike, is pretty typical that over a period of years, if we go back again, to me, I'm more of a student of history here and looking at how things progressed. If we go back to the days where we had canopy cab apparatus and they were cab forward, where the engine was in the jump seat area, or if you're from Maryland, my favorite expression, you're sitting in the bucket. You know, the front seat area was much more open because there wasn't an engine and a radiator and cooling system up there. And you go back in history, and because the floor was flat, it was pretty common even back 15 or 20 years ago that before SCBA seats themselves became common, people started putting angle brackets in with a mask mount for the officer's mask, because that was a result of, over a period of years, people realizing that the jump seat area, there really wasn't a need to have that seat back cushion there, and then people started putting SCBAs in there. Well, then in all sizes of departments, both career and volunteer, people realized, well, geez, the officer's mask now was carried in a compartment, and the folks were coming out of the jump seat or the buckets with their SCBAs on and maybe some tools, so we needed to make those same provisions for the officer. And some departments took that a step further, took an angle bracket, put it 45 degrees in the other direction over to the driver so the driver could mask up if needed once they arrived on a scene. And my sense is, Mike, over a period of years, that other than you mentioned, it was pretty common, maybe put a Halligan tool or a small officer's tool up somewhere in the front seat area, but the engine box area that sat between those two guys riding in the rear facing seats kind of became a mounting platform for equipment. You know, go way back when people were operating, open cab apparatus that had very narrow jump seat areas over the fenders, when there actually were fenders on fire trucks, that people typically mounted the axes over the fenders. Or you'd see a pick head on one side and a flathead on the other, and they weren't mounted in anything other fancier than a scabbard and a tulip clip to hold the handle, but they were outboard of the seating area. As we made that seating area wider over a period of years, and the engine boxes got wider and went from angled sides to flat sides, it became a natural mounting area for people to mount additional spare masks, sometimes spare bottles. I've seen people throw their standpipe packets up there. Irons mount became pretty common, and we really weren't thinking about what was going to happen with that stuff. Once we got in an accident, it was just an idea that you're sitting there, you can have your hand tool right there, and, you know, you come off the rig and we're ready to go to work.
Well, I think you brought up a good point there, Tom. I think that the firefighter mentality is that we're not going to have an accident. We're not going to wreck. We're not going to flip over. It happens to the other guy. It happens in big cities. It happens in one state or another, but it's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen here. I'm a good driver. I've never had any problems like this before, and they just don't think it's going to happen to them.
Yeah, Mike, I think you're right. That's one of the thoughts. And the other one is frankly that the historically, or the tradition within the fire service has been, is like, well, you know, and we'll make up the scenario here. If you had a 1985 canopy cab pumper before it got enclosed with four doors, the equipment was within reach. So we've had, in some cases, more than two generations of firefighters that's all that they've known, that the equipment has been within arm's reach of where you've happened to sit. And I think most of us will admit that if we've been in the service for any period of time, if you've ever ridden like Mike and myself have at different points in our career, in the rear of a canopy cab pumper in an open jump seat or bucket area, you tell me where the seatbelts were generally. I'd probably say in 98% of the rigs that I ever rode in, the seat belts were tucked behind the SCBA bracket or somehow stuck underneath the seat. They may have been there, but you certainly couldn't have gotten them on unless you were going to stand up and try to untangle them, because they were never used. So now we come back to what many of our listeners have heard before, the watershed year of 1991, where the NFPA mandates four-door enclosed cabs. Again, you go back and roll back in history, New York City was doing four-door cab units back in the 70s. They were doing it for different reasons, but they realized very early on that necessarily riding on the back step or standing in the jump seat or bucket area, while it had a cool factor that exceeded 10, was certainly not safe. So we needed to be seated. Were we belted in that era? Absolutely not. Belts were provided, but they were considered to be something that, frankly, only sissies wear. And anything initially that we could push, pull, or shove into that enclosed work area became okay, because we weren't, as Mike said, we weren't expecting the rig to be on its side or on its roof or to, you know, do a 360 and land back upright as you jauntily roll through the meadow. The reason we're discussing this is because Mike and I are very concerned that while we have improved safety in terms of the construction of the apparatus, there's bracketry out there that can safely retain the equipment, that the fire service in general just feels that, that's for those safety guys, and we don't really need to do that. I can tell you in my career, one of the things that has distressed me the most is to look at a piece of apparatus that was properly designed, that had bracketry to hold stuff in the cabs, and then find out, well, the first time or the second time it came off the unit with the irons, it wasn't going back in that irons lock. It was just thrown on the floor. Or worse yet, and this is where I think we're headed, to come back full circle, I was in a good-sized apartment a couple of weeks ago and opened up the crew cab doors on the left side and the right side, and here was an enclosed cabinet for their EMS gear. Pretty standard, not surprising, behind a nice little roll-up door. Mike, on either side of the EMS cabinet, on the driver's side, was a 2.5-gallon can in a conventional fire extinguisher bracket. No 9G bracket, just put on the floor with that little flip-to-turn latch. And on the other side, not to outdo themselves, was a 15-pound CO2 extinguisher. Now, I had to like walk away from the rig because I was afraid that my smirk or I was going to say something that was going to be offensive to the, you know, nice person that was taking me around and showing me the rigs in the station. But I had to go back to one of your favorite expressions that, that I love. What the hell were they thinking? You know, we put our EMS gear and an AED and O2 bag and the jump bag that's all nice soft devices. Yeah, that stuff could hurt you as well. That's behind a roll-up door. And then we had a pair of irons that was sitting on the floor together with an 2.5-gallon can and a 15-pound CO2 in a standard bracket. Now, again, go back history. Years ago, where was that stuff? Compartments on the tailboard, and probably in that same bracket when we had rear steps and beaver tails. Now we don't have rear steps. We don't have beaver tails anymore. Maybe they thought their compartment space, and on this unit, the enclosed compartment space within the body, but yet somebody thought it would be a great idea to put the fire extinguishers and mount them inside the cab. I'm somewhat speechless over that. So it kind of brings us to talk about our attitudes are for our listeners that we take safety to a point, and when we're in the apparatus specification process, we write all this detail about the size of the cabinets and where the doors are going to be and what kind of lights there's going to be. And, yeah, we need to have power inside that cabinet, and it's going to be tied in a shoreline so we can charge all this stuff. And that's all good. But then when we take delivery of the unit and aftermarket, we allow the department mechanic or my favorite fire chief of all time, Bucky Nutwelder, to go mount stuff outside the cabinet, we have just done a severe disservice to ourselves. And if you find yourself in a position like the brothers from St. Louis riding in that late 80s vintage Pierce Arrow canopy cab with a 50-foot telescope, you take a look at the video, but more importantly to our listeners, look at the still photos afterwards and look at where all of that equipment landed once the unit was on its side. It didn't flip over on its roof. It didn't do a 360. It didn't do a tumble saw. It just simply spun around and landed on its side. And you tell me what those guys were probably thinking. Right? Probably praying that somebody hadn't taken the pick head axe and thrown it in the old-style scabbard and tulip clip alongside the engine box, because I doubt that that would have stayed in place. So, Mike, from your perspective, what types of things, if you're operating a ladder company, what kinds of things do you really need inside the cab within immediate reach in the first 30 seconds of operation after you get out? Lord knows that on an aerial ladder, and particularly one that wasn't designed with a pump and a water tank, there is plenty of compartment space. There's the back walls of cabs, which New York City for years has famously used to mount their roof hooks and other pipe poles and stuff. When you come out of the cab, other than your appendages, what else, in your humble opinion, do people really need to come off a ladder company with? And then we'll address it in turn, and we'll talk a little bit about some other rigs as well.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Of course, this goes back to discussions that we had a long time ago on this show about, you know, SCBA in the cab versus SCBA not in the cab, and not to belabor that point, but certainly a couple of the vendors have done a good job in securing the SCBA into the cab now. And so that's generally not a problem. So I'd like to get off with an SCBA, and as an officer, I would like to get off with my flashlight and my officer's tool, and then maybe the thermal imaging camera, which all has 9G brackets and can easily be done inside the cab. As far as my firefighters in the rear, much of their equipment can be put in compartments adjacent to the door to get in the cab. We have two 2.5-gallon water cans, As you mentioned, the aforementioned New York City-style hooks and pipe poles and roof hooks that are mounted on the outside of the back of the cabin closure by that compartment. And then some of the things that we may not necessarily take advantage of that are out there, but the idea of taking a set of irons and mounting it on the compartment door that holds the 2.5 gallon can, the water extinguisher in it. On our rigs, they have a special cutout where there is no compartment door. They're just bolted onto the side of the truck in extinguisher brackets. But in many departments, I've seen where they take that first compartment door on the officer side by the crew cab, and they've put water extinguishers in there. They've mounted the hooks in the New York City style, and then on the door of that compartment or on one of those boards, mounting boards, they've mounted a set of irons there for the forcible entry guy. And then you could take a rabbit tool or the bunny tool or hydro ram, whatever your department calls it, and you could put it in that compartment as well. So the stuff is readily available, and you're ready to go to work, but yet it doesn't become a hazard. And then on the other side of the truck, basically my firefighters on our ladder company just carry Halligans and hooks, pipe poles, and again with the pipe poles being mounted right outside the cab, and then just take 9G brackets, and you could either mount them in the cab or you could mount them in that adjacent compartment on either the door A, or you could put it on one of those tool boards that are readily available as well, and you've made for really a safe ride. Some of the issues that are coming to bear with that, though, is that, as we've discussed again on this program, the new 1901 changes, they've made it clear that nobody should have a helmet on inside the cab of the apparatus, and so now we have helmets that we have to affix to the cab somehow, some way, otherwise they'll become flying projectiles as well. Any thoughts on that? And do you know what the industry is going to do to solve that problem as the end of 08 is getting closer, Tom, and we're getting into 09 and those changes?
That's a very, very good point, Mike, and that brings me to going back and fast-forwarding from the historical perspective of where we came, where we had a lot of space up in the front of the cab, and now by anybody's standards, while our arguments, the space within the driver's seat area and the officer's seat area, with now the engines in virtually all of these units, unless you happen to have a mid-engine design rig, the engine's up in front and has restricted that space. Now that the engine's up in front, we have this flat mounting surface, and that has created a place where most people now would want to mount. Mike mentioned about the hand lights. If you're in a volunteer organization where the portable radios are carried on the apparatus and it's not by your own PPE in a career department, as you're getting on the rig, you're putting on your PPE and then putting on the strap for the portable, people are using that space for potentially now for map book storage areas where they might want to carry a thermal imaging camera. And if you're going to do that, as Mike mentioned, I mean, there is tested bracketry out there that you can typically buy with the camera, so you're not, and as I saw in a photo of one department that had the camera in like its black poly box case, and that was just sitting loose on top of the engine box to slide wherever it wanted to slide as you stopped or accelerated. To go to the helmet thing, the issue there, there's one company that I'm aware of, Zymatic, has a bracket that they've come out with that they're marketing that will safely retain the helmet. The issue that I see, Mike, in taking that standard and actually putting it into practice from an application standpoint is to come up with enough surface mounting area within the cab where you can go mount if you've got seating for six personnel in the cab to be able to do that. The driver's gear sometimes is not an issue because that's in a separate compartment, either within the cab or outside in a body compartment, because the driver is typically not wearing all of his PPE, maybe beyond his bunker pants, while responding. But for the other riding members, that certainly becomes an issue. And for the all-volunteer organizations, for these people that have 8-person or 10-person cabs in their operation, or is going to replace one of those with one of these, you know, large 10-person cabs, you're just going to run out of room, Mike, to be able to do do all of this stuff. And that takes us to some of the studies that you have been working very heavily on with Gordon Routley for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, of doing, you know, as we talked about sizing up the building and sizing up the incident, we're working very heavily on sizing up ourselves to determine what is an appropriate room and space that we need to safely seat a firefighter within any one of the cabs that we currently use, to get that person in there in a position where they can be comfortable, they can be safe, there won't be any intrusions for them to be able to safely buckle up their seatbelt and harness and be able to safely put on their SCBA. So all of these things are starting to come together. And one of the threads, Mike, that I read, that somebody was commenting on the new New York City engine companies, and for one person's perspective, apparently this person was a chauffeur and the unit was only several weeks assigned to the station, but some of his commentary was, wow, the thing's a lot bigger than the last one, and we shouldn't have made the cabs any wider, and we should get exemptions from the EPA so we could go back to what we used to use. Very valid perspective and probably fair. But I think what our listeners need to understand is that we in the emergency services, with the different apparatus builders that are out there, we didn't get an exemption from the EPA in 2007. We are not going to get an exemption from the EPA in 2010. The bright light potentially at the end of the tunnel is with the fact that all of the custom chassis apparatus folks will have to design their product around the one available diesel engine that remains available to the emergency services, that possibly some cab designs might provide a little more room than when we're accustomed to. But you're limited. Most cabs now are between 96 to 100 inches wide, which provide you anywhere between 86 to maybe 88 inches of clear space on the inside. And if you take 88 inches and divide it by 4, and you said, I want to have 4 forward-facing seats, Mike, I can tell you it took me quite a while to get out of third-grade math at St. Margaret's Parochial School in Pearl River, New York, but when I divide 4 into 88, which is a best-case scenario, at 22 inches, I think that segues into you the fact that you found out that 22 or even 24 inches is not adequate. Now, so far, can you enlighten some of our listeners with what you found so far with some of the studies as we size up ourselves?
One thing that we found is that the measurements allotted for firefighters inside of the cab are just simply not enough for bunkered up firefighters in 2008. And I don't think anybody that's ridden in the bucket or the jump seat of the apparatus, we're not breaking any news to them or any new ground here. You know, that they've known that for a long time because they just simply don't fit. And what we found out as far as a seat dimension is that at a minimum there needs to be 25 inches, and at a maximum we could use up to 32 inches. And, of course, as you mentioned appropriately before, we're just running out of space in the cab enclosure between helmets and the new EPA engines and all the room that all that stuff is going to take up, plus larger U.S. firefighters in 2008 and beyond, and all of a sudden we're just there's just no more room at the inn. And
Mike, I think that's very well put. And as we get ready to go into break, we'll leave our listeners with this little thought. And this, Mike, this was my little sidebars over the last few days. If you were taking your family, and let's suppose it was you, your wife, and two children, for sake of argument, and you're going to put them in the family car, and you're going to go out for a little ride. It's fall season. If you're in upstate New York, you're going to go pick apples, right, or maybe buy some cider, you know, go out to the local orchard. If you were putting, including yourself, a family of four, in the Clark W. Griswold family truckster to go out for an hour, and you had your little small, modest, you know, three-drawer Craftsman toolbox, would you put the toolbox inside the car with your family, or would you take the toolbox or anything else that you had that you felt obligated to carry and put it in the trunk? I think there's a pretty strong parallel between that and our fire truck. If we're running down the road in a fire truck with our tools inside with the rest of our family, I think maybe we're potentially headed in the wrong direction unless we've retained everything properly and have policies in effect that will ensure that that stuff is retained properly. Or would we be better off saying, in our case, the trunk, our compartment space in the body, we would develop an intelligent place to go put that stuff and put the toolbox back in our compartment body, or would we throw it up in the back seat behind little Junior and Sis and hope that we didn't have to come to a sudden stop? Nice little thought. And on that, we'll take a break. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
All right, we're back. The apparatus architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, and we'd once again like to sincerely thank Task Force Tips for sponsoring our podcast, and would encourage folks to go check out their products and go to their website and then look at some of the fine things that Task Force Tips produces out of their facility. So we're very thankful for them to support us in some of the work that Michael and I are doing. So we're going to talk about now, what are a couple of just basic down and dirty tips, Michael, that you think that we can employ to be able to respond safer under that general umbrella?
Training, Tom. Training is the absolute key to all this. You know, we need to train. I think the wave of the future is going to be driving simulation. The idea of putting a 20-something young man behind the wheel of a $1.3 or $4 million ladder truck just to try it out, even if it's on a cone course in a parking lot with nobody in it, is just I just don't think that that's going to be the standard fare much longer. The military years ago started doing simulation to train pilots, thinking that it wasn't such a great idea to put a 20-something behind the controls of a 20 or $30 million or even a billion-dollar airplane. So I think that's one thing that we have to see. And just a cultural, we keep talking about this cultural change, whether it be through the National Fallen Firefighters or Foundation or in classes that you and I have done or classes that we've seen done or just in the print media or on firehouse.com. We need to change the culture of what we're doing. The idea that it's not acceptable to take unnecessary risks. It's not acceptable to ride around with Halligans and axes in cabs. It's not loose. It's not acceptable to blast through red lights. I can honestly say in my 27 years in the Bronx, I have yet to go to a fire where 30 seconds difference one way or the other cost somebody their life or saved their life. And this idea that we just have to rush around with chickens with our heads cut off and this adrenaline rush and just getting everybody yelling and screaming, I just don't see it, quite frankly. There's just no room for it on the fire ground. And we just have to change the way that we conduct ourselves and the way that we deliver the services that we deliver. And we need to change sooner rather than later. And not for the sake of change, Tom, but just rather the fact that what we're doing right now, quite frankly, it's just not working very well.
Yeah, Michael, I couldn't agree more. And I think there's a very strong parallel between training opportunities and how the military views training and a regiment of operations of how a certain tactic is going to actually be played out. You mentioned about simulators with operating the planes and things like that. Is that the fire service traditionally, and there may be some of our listeners, if you've been in the fire service for less than 10 years, you, all due respect, you don't have an appreciation for the long-standing tradition within the fire services. We considered ourselves for many years to be a paramilitary organization. Just a couple of days ago, I was watching, I'm a fanatic of watching vintage World War II movies, and it was a quick movie shot on of Navy pilots training to land their planes on aircraft carriers. Obviously something that's pretty difficult and could be parallel with maybe some particular operation that we do in the fire service, where you do it right and you're safe, you do it wrong, you're injured, more than likely, you're dead. And I think there's some strong parallels between flying and driving apparatus, or driving apparatus in an irresponsible manner.
And in fact, Tom, in some departments, flying and driving may actually be more parallel than we even know.
That could very well be true. Well, at any rate, this movie was made like in 1946, when the war was just in the process of winding down, and this Navy pilot was trying to land his plane with somewhat of a little bit of a cowboy approach and did not pay attention to the wave off. This was prior to having the ball system that they use on aircraft carriers now. And he goes to land his plane, catches the last little guy wire, comes to a stop. Everybody's like gasping, like, oh my God, you know, why did he do that? And he gets up in front of the executive officer, and the executive officer dresses him down, Mike, and the pilot goes to say, sir, I have an explanation. And the executive officer of the ship said, son, I don't want to listen to any explanations, and turned around and walked out of the room. Now, that was pretty harsh. By today's standards, we would consider, wow, that was kind of tough love there, all right? Maybe in the fire service, we need to have that approach that Mike spoke about of changing our attitudes, is that when we do something and we get close to having an accident or cause an accident, our natural human reaction is, well, I have an explanation for my acts here. We don't want an explanation, because if the act and the incident hadn't occurred, there'd be no reason for the explanation. And the culture in today's fire service is partially people that don't have any of the background or tradition of where the service has come from, and just feel that, kind of like the proverbial free-range chicken, we can kind of go out and do whatever we want. We know the guideline says that, but that's an SOG, and we can kind of get close to that. We can get close to the edge of the road, but we feel like we're never really going to go off into the shoulder of the road. And as we all know, that happens more often than not. So that's very good words there, Brother Mike. We do have a couple of questions. We had one from one of our listeners that said, have a couple of questions. First, rear mount pumpers are becoming more and more popular. What do you think about rear mount pumpers, and with the economically spurned trend of smaller and more efficient apparatus, do you think rear mount pumpers are a good choice for greater functionality for the dollar? Well, there's question one. We'll address that real quick.
Yeah. Are you asking me what I think about pumpers, Brother Tom?
No, Mike. We're
not
gonna
much.
We're going to let you sit on the sidelines and listen to this one, okay?
Okay.
Real, Rear mount pumpers are a good choice if your department is looking to combine services of a standalone rescue vehicle and a standalone engine company to get the two of those combined so you have more compartment space and something that is in a smaller package. Not that there's any empirical evidence to this, but I think if Mike were to look at some of the more tragic accidents where we're looking at drivers or operators who were not properly trained to operate these massively long, big, heavy, and in some cases, arguably, yes, folks, top-heavy rigs, that rear-mount units, which tend to be smaller and compact and easier to maneuver, does easier equal safety? I'm not going out on that limb, but I would support that if you look at major city fire departments in urban areas, you typically don't see them running around in 38-foot-long engine company apparatus. But you will see people in other jurisdictions run around on a 34, 35, 36, 37-foot-long fire truck, top mount pumper or whatever, 8-person raised roof cab, and think that that's just grand. That might be grand if you're running down a road straight and a Memorial Day parade might not work every day of the week for you. So Mike and I feel strongly that the smaller, more compact that you can make the unit, it, as long as it meets the missions of what your department's looking to do, and rear mounts is a type of apparatus that lends itself to that category, can work out very, very well for you. The second part of the gentleman's question was, and this is very timely given the state of our economy and with the pending elections coming up, and if you have any interest in the stock market or have any amount of dollars invested away in a 401k, this hits close to home. My department's trying to create a replacement schedule for apparatus to address our needs for the next 25 years. Great idea, because you want to be forward-thinking. You don't want to wait for something to happen. It's great to have a plan. In your experience, what's a realistic yearly inflation rate for the cost of new apparatus, and how much should the budget be for NFPA changes in the future? All right, kind of a two-part question there. First, with respect, we'll do the last one first. NFPA changes in the future. It's tough to forecast what the NFPA might put into future standards. The standard that's going to take effect here in January 1, reasonable numbers out there. If it's a custom chassis apparatus, expect the increased cost for those changes to be somewhere in the area of about $8,000 to $10,000. And if it's a commercial chassis apparatus, a little bit more, because you've got to integrate some more of the equipment items into that. It could potentially be as much as maybe $12,000 to $13,000 on a commercial chassis. In the future, it's going to be tough to predict what the NFPA changes are going to be, because we really don't know what things are actually going to come out into play. So we're not trying to dodge the question there, but you know, it suffice to say that this most recent round cost an $8,000 to $10,000 in my world and Brother Mike's world. That's a good chunk of money. The old proverbial expression that my dad used to use when I was a youngster and would be hitting them up for like an increase on the allowance, or I wanted to go buy a new model, you know, to go put AMT model put together, he would look at me straight in the eyes and go, "Son, money does not grow on trees." And I think we in the fire service are beginning to learn that, because with the state of the economy and how that's impacted in the past, up prior to 2008, fire apparatus normally had one annual price increase of anywhere between 3 to 5%. Sometimes a manufacturer would project that he's going to increase his cost over the period of time, 5%, and maybe increase it 2.5% or 3% at one point during the year, and at the latter point of the year approaching December or into January would increase it another 2%. This year, because of the high cost of raw materials, Mike and I have talked about that on prior podcasts, material costs have gone through the roof on apparatus. So this year, and it's likely not to change in the near future, fire apparatus costs have gone up anywhere from 8 to 12% during the course of this year. And until our economy in the United States stabilizes, the value of the dollar becomes stronger in the world market, as long as we're facing high inflation costs due to materials, and that's just starting to come down a little bit, I think you would be safe to project for future apparatus purchases, at least for the next 2 to 3 years. Certainly it's impossible for anybody to crystal ball what you need to project out 20 or 25 years in advance, Mike, but I think it's reasonable to expect for the next 2 to 3 years, annual inflationary costs for apparatus will probably be somewhere nominally in the area of 5 to 8%. With what we're facing with the 2010 engines, the next round that would come out of the NFPA guidelines, suffice to say that it's not going to go up at 2, 3, or 4% a year. 5 to 8 is probably a nominal number, and that's going to certainly cause some financial folks, the people that hold the purse strings in your community, to have to take a big, deep breath before you go hit them up for your next apparatus purchase. So I know, Mike, you've got a couple of questions that folks sent in to you. What do you got to hear at?
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. One had to do with seatbelts. A group wrote into to our website about seatbelts and the fact that I'm conducting some seatbelt use training in my department, which is pretty interesting. We're actually going to train people how to use seatbelts. That's a novel but correct approach. Some of the seatbelts or lap belts are difficult to use. They are hard to reach on the inside of the seat. So they make a viable extension for seatbelts, and if so, do you know of any vendors that I could look into? I did some research and have not found any info of value. I have not been able to get anywhere on this subject with our vendor mechanic. Any advice you could send me would be greatly appreciated. Your assistance, and it's from Captain Tracy from PMFD. What do we know? We know that the airport airplane extenders, seat extensions like that, nobody is going to sanction in the fire service. There's just too much in the way of liability concerns for that. But what we do know that you can do, and I had it happen once before, it was a Freightliner E1 pumper, and emergency one was contacted, and they took the truck in, and they replaced the female stalks, and that's the proper terminology for the seatbelt tent. They replaced the female stalks with longer stalks, and they come in sizes anywhere from 6 inches to upwards of a foot or more. And by getting the female stalks extended, it made for more room, obviously, and the seatbelts work better. But it's really a slippery slope because of all the liability issues involved. The idea of sending, and this idea was broached during this period of time where they were going to send the seatbelt extenders to the department mechanic to put on, and then the manufacturer poo-pooed that idea and said, no, we're going to have our guy put them on. And just many, many liability concerns there as it relates to it. But the bottom line is that there are longer female stalks out there available, but you do have to work through the individual manufacturer of the apparatus to achieve some kind of remedy for that situation. Any thoughts or comments on that from you, Tom?
Yeah, Mike, the limited experience I have in that area parallels what you said. It'd be one of the things we could say to customers that have units that are being built, and certainly go back and research them in your fleet. If you've heard the common excuses like, well, the belt just doesn't fit, then let's have a seatbelt drill. Let's take the smallest to largest person in your department, put them in the seats that you would normally expect them to be in, and check to validate that the seat belts do work properly, or that maybe you do need to get seat belt extenders. And this goes back to our discussions before of just, you know, going along and feeling like, well, yeah, we know there's the problem, and everybody acknowledged it and knew it was there, but everybody failed to do something about it. If our listeners get anything out of this month's podcast, we'd like to think, you know, particularly with cold weather coming on in some departments there, you know, beginning to think it's okay, our outside activities are going to wind down a little bit because of climatic conditions. Well, here's one great idea for an inside drill. You go over and check over the apparatus for loose items or things that are not permanently mounted and located within compartments, most importantly within the passenger's compartment. Have a seatbelt drill. Have everybody go over and check their PPE. Make sure that all of that equipment is in good order. Get them to gear up, sit in the apparatus, and find out who doesn't fit. And if somebody doesn't fit, then do something about it. Don't put it under the cloak of darkness and just figure, well, let's hope that Bill just never does ride engine 3, because we know that he, when he's geared up, he doesn't fit in the seat, and we know he's not going to put the seatbelt on. Then just be proactive and do something about it. So that's going to take us to our last thing, and Mike, we'll let you go first. What have you seen lately? Anything this year that really impressed you, where you you thought that was either a piece of equipment or a procedure or something that worked very well?
Well, I think just overall, just the amount of time, effort, and money that's been expended in fire custom cab safety measures. The roll tech rollover protection, the frontal airbag protection, the new SCBA holder crash protection, all those enhancements have really taken something that at one time was fairly dangerous to ride in and just has made it markedly safer. And I know, just having worked with some of the OEMs that build some of this stuff, that they're just still working and constantly just trying to improve a firefighter safety, for which we're very grateful. But riding in a fire truck cab today, a custom fire truck cab with all these safety additions, has just made the job far safer than it's ever been riding around in this stuff, in a time, quite frankly, when that added measure of safety is absolutely needed, given how we started the show with just the inattentiveness of the public out there on the roadways that just create an ever-present danger to anybody that has to drive one of these big trucks and try to arrive at the scene of a fire safely. How about you, Tom?
Well, Mike, I'll tell you, this one thing that kind of hits close to home, because geographically it is pretty close to where I live, but within the last, since our last podcast, I had several occasions to stop by and visit the City of Syracuse, New York, fire department shops. Some of our listeners will remember that we had a guest on our program there a month or so ago. It was Captain David Ogden from the Syracuse Fire Department, and Captain Ogden has now since retired after spending 30 years on the job there, and the department shops are under the capable leadership of District Chief Dave Reeves. And I had occasion to stop in there, Mike, to look at several, in their terminology, mini pumpers, which really don't have any the pumping capability, but they're the vehicle that the City of Syracuse uses to deliver EMS service within the fire department. And they have, each of their engine companies is equipped with one of these, and the department was in the process of outfitting the two newest units, which were on Ford, I believe they were F-450, four-wheel drive, four-door cab chassis, with a removable modular fiberglass body that was installed at the shops, and they were in the process of outfitting these with radios and emergency warning lights and little small things like taking the time to make cutouts in the body and in the forward part of the cab to install intersection lights. The backs of the bodies were equipped with retro-reflective material and a chevron striping. And then they were going to give each of these units, one was, I believe, was going to be assigned to Engine Company 5, the other one was going to the rescue company. And both of those ones had slightly different needs. And they were then going to get their tools and equipment laid out, brought back to the shops, properly mounted by the shops, and then put out in the service. So it was somewhat of a labor-intensive issue, which was one thing that struck me, Mike. The other thing was it was things that were being done within the shops. They just didn't hire out the vendors and say, okay, how much are you going to charge for this? How much are you going to charge for that? The lighting was being installed by some of their talented shop folks. The lettering package and the chevrons were done, nominally by an outside lettering shop. But it really kind of took me back and said, in the days where, because of my background in the apparatus industry, that people just say, well, we're gonna pay to have somebody do all this. And the expression is we want this vehicle turnkey. When it comes in, we just want to put water in the tank and throw our gear on there and we're going to work. So it was somewhat of like an old school throwback to me that here was a department that, struggling like many communities are with the financial realities of the day, that they were taking the time to kind of do things right, get the company input to let the companies, tell the shop folks where they wanted to have the tools and equipment mounted. And to go back to what we were discussing, I'm sure when those rigs are in service, you're not going to open up the inside of the cab and see a toolbox or a pair of irons lying on the floor. Things were going to be done and done right. And, again, on a very small scale, it's the kind of thing is it was like you could tell that the fellows working on the rigs had a lot of pride about what they were doing, and it was just kind of like a nice little bit of an afternoon there to spend with now retired Captain Ogden to look at what they were doing and doing it on a limited budget. Some people's perspective would be like, well, we would never do that in my community. For what Syracuse did, somebody else would go out, Mike, and probably spend $200,000 and, go buy it from a vendor and turn and have it to be a turnkey operation. But there are ways to get safe apparatus out there without having to break the bank, I guess, was one of the nice things that I came away with. So we hope this episode of a podcast of the Apparatus Architects has been enlightening to our listeners. If anything, you can tell that if as we wind into the fastly approaching holiday season, Brother Mike and I are really hecked up now, even more so than we were earlier in the year, on safety. And as the year winds down and we look at some of the things that people have done very well, we're not out to bash those folks that are running around and doing things foolishly, but I don't think you need to go too far in it, no matter where you happen to be geographically, to look at a department that might not be up to grade on a lot of the things that we've discussed. So we hope that our listeners respond to runs and be safe out there. So from Tom Shan and then Brother Michael Wilbur, this is the Apparatus Architects, and we look forward to hearing again from you very soon. Thanks, and stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.